You're now tuned in to Cognitive Flow, brought to you by OptimalAnesthesia.com, where clinical insight meets focused clarity. Welcome back, everyone. Today, we are undertaking what I really think is one of the most clinically crucial deep dives we've ever tackled here.
Mm-hmm.
We're not focusing on, you know, a fancy new drug or the latest monitoring gadget. Instead, we're digging into something relentless, unavoidable, the physiological impact of time itself.
Right, aging.
Exactly. We're diving deep into how cardiovascular aging systematically changes anesthetic risk. It forces us, really, to move beyond generic protocols and adopt much more precision-guided care.
Yeah, you can't just treat everyone the same.
No. Well, it's not just managing a patient. It's about understanding the, let's say, four physiological chapters of their life and what each chapter means when they land in the operating room. Think of this deep dive as, well, a necessary guided map showing us exactly where the pitfalls are in an aging circulation.
That map analogy is perfect. Because the challenge isn't just that our patients are getting older, right? It's that the underlying plumbing, the whole cardiovascular system, it's fundamentally changed. And it changes in these four predictable sort of cascading stages.
Okay.
We really have to start managing, say, an 80-year-old heart. Like, it's just a slightly more fragile 40-year-old heart. It's not. It operates under completely different rules.
Right. Different physiology.
Different physiology entirely. So our mission today is to explore those four distinct stages of cardiovascular aging, understand the unique molecular stuff driving them, the physiological risks of each stage, and critically lay out the specific perioperative roadmaps we need for safety at every single phase.
Okay, so before we jump right into stage I, let's maybe anchor ourselves with that foundational analogy the source material gave us. I found this really helpful for framing the whole discussion, especially when we start talking about things like pressure waves and pulsatility, the city's plumbing system analogy.
Oh yeah, it's genuinely the perfect mental model. It really helps visualize the mechanics.
Right.
So in a youthful system, right, your plumbing has these super flexible large pipes,
right,
a strong, robust central pump, and really responsive pressure gauges, valves. Everything adjusts instantly. If demand spikes, the system just handles it. No problem.
Smooth sailing.
Smooth sailing. But, you know, as time goes on, the arteries stiffen, the pipes get rigid, the valves might start to leak a bit, the sensors, like our baroreceptors, their signals slow down, their response time lags.
Okay.
And crucially, the main pump, the heart itself, starts to remodel structurally. Now, water still flows okay most of the time. You know, the city keeps running.
Day to day, it's fine.
Day to day, fine. But then, bam. A sudden severe storm hits.
Yeah.
The system needs immediate high volume flow under major stress. And that's when the weak points, those stiff pipes, the sluggish sensors, that's when they fail. Catastrophically sometimes.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because that's exactly what surgery and anesthesia are, aren't they? They are that stress test. They're the storm hitting this weakened, rigid system, demanding perfect, immediate hemodynamic compensation from a body that's just structurally not capable of delivering it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
We induce vasodilation, myocardial depression, then we ask the system to cope with maybe rapid blood loss, position changes.
Yeah, it's a huge demand.
It is. So let's chart this progression. Let's start at the beginning, the early end of the spectrum, with stage I. So stage I. This is defined by the very first, often quite subtle, physiological shift. The loss of aortic elasticity. We used that garden hose analogy before, and it really works here.
It does.
It's like that hose that used to be super flexible, easy to coil up, but now it kind of resists bending. It might even crack if you try to force it too much.
Exactly.
The aorta, the body's biggest and most vital pressure-dampening artery, it's starting to stiffen up.
And this stiffening, it's important to realize, it's not just passive wear and tear. It's actually an active biological process. It's driven by enzymes breaking things down.
Okay, so what's doing the damage?
Well, the source material points to key culprits. These matrix metalloproteinases, specifically MMP2 and MMP9. Their normal job is tissue remodeling, but with aging, they kind of go into overdrive.
Oh.
They start chewing through the crucial elastin proteins in the aortic wall. Elastin, that's what gives the vessel its stretchiness, its ability to recoil smoothly. When that's gone, the aorta loses its shock absorber function.
Okay, so it can't buffer the pressure anymore.
Right. And at the same time, you see increased oxidative stress and a big reduction in nitric oxide, NO, bioavailability. This really messes with the smooth muscle's ability to relax and widen. So that vasodilatory reserve, it gets cut down dramatically.
So, okay, the aorta isn't buffering pressure well, and the vessels can't relax easily.
Yeah.
What's the clear clinical sign we should actually be looking for when we assess a patient before surgery?
It translates pretty directly into a physical marker, a widened pulse pressure. You know, PP, we might see a blood pressure reading like, say, 160 over 70. That gives you a pulse pressure of 90.
Wow, that's high.
It is. And this isn't just, you know, high blood pressure. That widened gap between the systolic and diastolic, ideally, pulse pressure should be under 60 mmHg. That gap is a critical, measurable biomarker of stiff pipes.
Okay.
The systolic is high because the rigid aorta can't buffer the pressure wave from the ventricle, and the diastolic is low because without that recoil, the pressure just dissipates too quickly. It's the physical sign of lost elasticity.
And this biomarker, this widened pulse pressure, it sets the stage for that first big anesthetic trap, the induction crisis.
Mm.
Let's talk specifically about the propofol bolus effect here.
Ah, yes, the classic failure mode.
Yeah.
Propofol, we know, is a potent, fast-acting peripheral vasodilator, and it's also a mild to moderate myocardial depressant.
Right.
So when you give it as a bolus, especially a rapid one, to this stage I patient, it hits that stiff circulation like, well, like pouring a bucket of water into that cracked, unyielding hose you mentioned.
So the pressure just plummets.
Plummets, because the sudden drop in systemic vascular resistance, the SVR, it goes uncompensated.
But why uncompensated? I mean, in a younger patient, wouldn't the Baroreflex jump in and try to rescue the pressure?
Exactly. That's what should happen. The body's primary instantaneous rescue system is the Baroreflex. It's meant to detect that falling pressure and immediately signal the heart to speed up and vessels to constrict.
But not here.
But in stage I aging, the Baroreflex arc itself is sluggish. The signals going up are delayed, the central processing is slower, and the response coming back, the actual release of catecholamines, is blunted. It tries, yes, but it's late and ineffective.
Mm.
This leads to a period of profound, often prolonged hypotension. It can easily last several critical minutes, causing tissue hypoperfusion before we even get the airway secured sometimes.
So this isn't just a quick dip. Mm. It's sustained low pressure in a system that can't handle it. So the key pearl then for stage I, the thing that has to guide our anesthetic, it seems crystal clear. Treat that pulse pressure, especially if it's over 60 mmHg, treat it like a vital sign, a proactive warning signal of aortic stiffness.
Absolutely. And this demands a tactical shift in our strategy. First, induction needs to be slow. I'm talking careful titration. Maybe divide a standard propofol dose over, say, 60 to 90 seconds instead of just pushing it fast. Give that sluggish Baroreflex and the rigid system a chance to try and adjust.
Okay, slow down the induction. What else?
Second, anticipate the need for vasoconstriction. Have norepinephrine immediately ready. Maybe even start a very low-dose infusion before induction. Its main action is pure vasoconstriction, which is exactly what these patients desperately need to keep their baseline SVR up.
And you specifically mentioned avoiding large phenylephrine boluses. Why is that? Because, you know, phenylephrine is often the go-to for fixing pressure quickly.
That's a really crucial nuance. Phenylephrine is a pure alpha agonist, right? It causes profound vasoconstriction. But remember, the stage I heart has that slow, inefficient Baroreflex.
Right.
So a big slug of phenylephrine can spike the pressure dramatically. That sudden spike then further stimulates the already overwhelmed Baroreflex.
Ah, causing a reflex bradycardia.
Exactly. A profound reflex bradycardia. And since the heart can't speed up quickly to compensate for that big pressure swing, you basically trade one problem, hypotension, for another, potentially worse one. Severe bradycardia plus a transiently very high afterload.
Okay, that makes sense.
Norepinephrine, because it has that balanced alpha and just modest beta 1 effect, gives you the vasoconstriction you need, but also helps support the heart rate. That's why it's generally preferred in this population.
All right, moving into stage 2. Now, the arteries aren't just stiffly resisting flow. They're actively messing with the hemodynamics, creating these pressure waves that actually bounce back and threaten the heart itself. This is the bounce back problem.
Yeah, it's basically a physics problem happening inside the circulation. Imagine a wave, a pressure pulse traveling down an artery. In a young, flexible artery, that wave dissipates, reflects way downstream. By the time it bounces back, the heart's already well into its next beat, and the timing works out perfectly. But in a rigid stage 2 artery, the pulse wave travels much, much faster, so the reflection point. It comes back way earlier, colliding with the next outgoing wave while the heart is still relaxing. That's the bounce back.
That collision sounds, well, bad. physiologically devastating,
how
does it actually show up on our monitor?
It has two really critical effects. First, it amplifies the systolic peaks. The returning wave hits the outgoing wave, pushing the top number up. This gives you that classic isolated systolic hypertension, or ISH.
Got it. High systolic.
But second, and this is way more dangerous from our perspective, it simultaneously steals from the diastolic troughs. The pressure dissipates faster, and the diastolic pressure, the DBP, falls, often critically low, sometimes below 60 mmHg.
Okay, and here's where it gets really interesting, right? Because we're often so focused on mean arterial pressure, MAP, as the sort of holy grail for perfusion. But in stage two, that falling diastolic pressure becomes an acute threat to the heart itself, a coronary crisis.
Precisely. We absolutely have to remember this. While MAP drives general organ perfusion, brain, kidneys, etc., the coronary arteries, the ones feeding the heart muscle, they fill almost exclusively during diastole, when the ventricle is relaxed.
Okay.
The whole coronary filling process, especially for the subendocardium, the most vulnerable part of the heart muscle, it's driven by the pressure gradient between the aorta, your DBP, and the left ventricle. If that diastolic pressure drops, especially below, say, 55 or 60, the heart muscle starves.
Wow.
You can have an MAP that looks okay, maybe 75, but if the DBP is 50, you are actively causing myocardial ischemia. We could be seeing silent heart attacks happening right there on the monitor.
And structurally, what's pushing things from just elasticity loss in stage one to this kind of irreversible rigidity in stage two? What's happening at the molecular level?
And now we're talking about permanent changes like cementation and severe fibrosis. The molecular bad guys here are the advanced glycation end products, AGAs. They bind to their receptors called RAGE. Right, the age-RAGE interaction. It essentially acts like superglue, forming these cross-links that cement the collagen fibers together. Makes the vessel walls hard, inflexible, totally unyielding.
Like rebar instead of flexible tubing.
Exactly. And on top of that, you've got potent growth factors like TGFF, transforming growth factor beta, and endothelin 1 driving profound fibrosis. They're actively replacing flexible functional tissue with stiff, scar-like tissue. The vessel is now physically locked into this rigid state.
So clinically, this means the absolute worst thing you can let happen during surgery is tachycardia, right? Especially if the patient already has that isolated systolic hypertension and a lowish DBP.
Oh, it's the double whammy for ischemia. Tachycardia, a fast heart rate, severely shortens the time available for diastolic filling. You shrink the window when the coronaries can actually get blood.
Makes sense.
Now combine that short filling time with a critically low filling pressure. That low DBP and myocardial oxygen supply just plummets. Ischemia is almost guaranteed. If the heart rate creeps up past 85 or 90, you're basically choking the myocard.
So our critical pearl for stage two is absolutely clear. DBP is the coronary lifeline. Got to watch it like a hawk.
Absolutely. And our strategy has to focus on protecting that lifeline and preventing tachycardia. We need to keep the heart rate ideally between 60 and 75 beats per minute, slow enough to maximize that diastolic filling window, but fast enough to maintain cardiac output.
Right, that sweet spot.
And critically, keep the DBP at or above 60 mmHg. Again, we tend to prefer norepinephrine because it boosts SVR, which directly supports DBP, but without causing the severe bradycardia that pure phenylephrine might trigger.
And for controlling that heart rate?
For fine-tuning the heart rate, agents like esmolol or maybe rumafentanil infusions are great tools. They let you titrate precisely to keep the heart rate in that 60-75 range without causing big hemodynamic swings or having to rely on long-acting beta blockers given pre-op. All right, stage three. This is really the consequence of stage two's violence. Those rigid, high-pressure, large vessels, they're now pushing excessive, unfiltered pulsatility, those huge, undampened pressure waves downstream into the really delicate small vessels. The microcirculation of the brain, the kidneys, the organs.
Ah, this is the fire hydrant blasting the garden sprinklers analogy you mentioned.
Exactly that. The small, fine vessels just can't handle the sheer force coming down the line from the stiff aorta and main arteries.
So what happens to them?
Well, the microcirculation starts to sustain significant damage, both functionally and structurally. Molecularly, we see severe oxidative stress, often generated by enzymes like NADPH oxidase. This directly damages the delicate endothelial lining and the tissue around it. In the brain, specifically, this leads to astrocyte dysfunction, which basically messes up the entire system of cerebral autoregulation. That's the system designed to keep blood flow constant, even when blood pressure changes. When autoregulation fails, blood flow becomes totally pressure dependent.
And that breakdown means the old rules of thumb for resuscitation just don't apply anymore, do they? We're usually taught that a mean arterial pressure, a MAP, of 65 is kind of the safe floor for young, healthy adults. But you're saying in a stage 3 patient, that's actually dangerous.
It is. It's very likely grossly insufficient. Because that autoregulation is impaired and the microvessels themselves are stiff, the patient needs a higher driving pressure just to get blood into the tissues. These patients often meet a MAP of 70 to 75, maybe even a bit higher sometimes, just to push blood past that impaired autoregulation and into the capillaries of the brain and kidneys.
So if we stick to the generic MAP of 65,
we're effectively hypoperfusing them, even if the number looks acceptable based on old standards.
And the immediate clinical outcomes of letting that MAP hover too low. These are the complications we really dread seeing in the recovery room, aren't they?
They are predictable, unfortunately. The most immediate one is often postoperative delirium. You know, confusion, severe agitation. Maybe the patient just isn't waking up properly. A PCU storm.
Yeah.
But the really silent killer, the one that often pops up days later, is acute kidney injury, AKI. It's often this delayed, quiet crash that ends up causing readmission or really prolonging recovery, all because the kidneys took a microvascular hit during the surgery when the MAP was allowed to linger at inadequate levels.
So the pearl for stage 3 isn't just about hitting a certain MAP number. It's about time. It's not just the lowest MAP that matters, but the duration spent below that critical threshold, maybe around 65 mmHg, this idea of cumulative hypotensive burden.
Correct. Studies have shown a direct link between the total time spent with MAP below 65 mmHg and the chances of developing AKI and also myocardial injury, MINS. Every minute spent down in that zone adds up, compounding the microvascular damage. So the strategy here has to prioritize pressure support and protection. If we're struggling to maintain that crucial MAP of 70-75, we really need to prefer norepinephrine or another vasopressor over just dumping in large fluid boluses.
Why the strong preference for pressors over fluids, even if maybe the volume status seems a bit uncertain?
Because the core problem in stage 3 is usually about vascular tone and failed autoregulation, not necessarily just being dry. If you overload a stiff system with fluids, you risk pulmonary edema and fluid overload without even guaranteeing you'll get the pressure up adequately, especially if the patient's already starting to show signs of HFPEF, which is stage 4.
Right.
We need to maintain vascular tone and driving pressure. Plus, we have to be really careful with anesthetic depth. Going too deep severely drops SVR, which is exactly what we're fighting to maintain. And finally, if you have access to tools like cerebral oximetry, they can give you real-time, non-invasive feedback on how the brain is actually tolerating those pressures, letting you make adjustments instantly.
Okay, so we've traced the damage from the big vessels in stage 1 down through the microcirculation in stage 3. Now, in stage 4, the constant burden of that chronic stiffness and high pulsatility finally forces the central pump itself, the heart, to fundamentally remodel.
Mm-hmm.
The heart muscle actually thickens and stiffens. It transforms into something much less pliable. You use the analogy of a balloon that's been patched and scarred, covered in thick leather.
Yeah.
It makes it really resistant to filling.
That's a great way to put it. This irreversible change is what we diagnose as heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, or HFPEF. And it's critical to understand this is fundamentally different from the classic heart failure, HFREF, where the ejection fraction is reduced.
How so?
In HFPEF, the systolic squeeze, the actual push function of the heart, often looks normal or pretty close to normal on an echo. The entire problem lies in the diastolic phase. The heart simply cannot relax, expand, and fill effectively. It's a severe problem of filling and relaxation.
So what's happening deep down molecularly to cause this muscle rigidity? Why can't it relax properly?
Well, the pathology really centers on messed up calcium handling within the heart muscle cells. We see significant dysfunction in something called CIRCA2A. That's the sarcoplasmic reticulum CHE2 plus ATPase.
Okay, CIRCA2A. What does it do?
Its main job is crucial. It rapidly pumps calcium back into storage inside the cell after each contraction. This allows the muscle fibers to fully relax. When CIRCA2A isn't working well, calcium clearance slows down. This leads to prolonged systolic contraction and therefore incomplete diastolic relaxation.
So the muscle stays partly contracted.
Stays stiff. Mm-hmm. Now combine that with other signaling pathways like calcineurin and NAT, which drive further structural fibrosis in the heart muscle matrix. And you end up with this rigid, non-compliant chamber that just cannot accept blood volume easily.
Given that stiffness, these stage 5 hearts develop two extreme dependencies that make them incredibly fragile under anesthesia. You mentioned they are highly preload dependent and rhythm dependent. Let's focus on rhythm dependence first, because that often seems to be the trigger for immediate collapse.
Yeah, it's absolutely critical. Because the ventricle is so stiff and can't passively suck blood in during diastole, it becomes almost entirely reliant on the atrium, the smaller chamber above it, to actively squeeze and push that final bolus of blood into the ventricle right before it contracts.
That's the atrial kick.
And in these stiff hearts, that kick can contribute maybe 20%, even up to 40% of the patient's final stroke volume.
Yeah.
Without that synchronized, forceful squeeze, the ventricle just doesn't fill enough, and cardiac output plummets instantly.
Which means the single most immediate crisis for these HFpEF patients is losing that synchronized sinus rhythm. Most commonly, that means new onset atrial fibrillation, or AF.
It's an instantaneous emergency. The moment AF hits, you lose that coordinated, powerful atrial kick. The whole house of cards just falls apart right then and there. Cardiac output can drop by a third or more, filling pressures collapse, and the patient can become profoundly hypotensive and ischemic almost immediately. And furthermore, we as clinicians can inadvertently make things worse just by using our standard ventilator settings. Positive pressure ventilation, especially with high levels of PEEP, actively impedes venous return. It steals preload from the heart.
Right.
In a patient whose HFpEF heart is already desperately fighting for every last drop of volume, putting them on a ventilator, especially with high PEEP, can precipitate profound circulatory collapse.
So the stage 4 AV parole seems pretty definitive. In HFpEF, rhythm is life and preload is paramount.
Yeah.
You mess with either and you're in deep trouble.
Absolutely. The strategy here has to be strictly conservative and totally focused on rhythm. Maintain sinus rhythm by any means necessary. Control the heart rate, ideally keeping it between 60 and 70 beats per minute to maximize whatever limited filling time they have. Again, norepinephrine remains preferred over aggressive fluid administration. Giving too much fluid will just back up into the lungs because the heart can't accept it, causing pulmonary edema. And we have to be acutely aware of our vent settings, minimize PEEP, manage tidal volumes carefully, do everything to reduce that preload impedance.
And if unstable AF does happen?
Treat it aggressively and immediately. That likely means electrical cardioversion or fast-acting rhythm control agents like amiodarone, whatever it takes to get back to that vital sinus rhythm as quickly as possible. So if we kind of zoom out now and connect all these stages, look at the bigger picture, it becomes really clear we need to shift our whole assessment paradigm. Understanding the vascular and cardiac stage is vital, yes, but there are also some overarching principles that apply to pretty much all aging patients. We have to stop managing just an age number and start managing physiological reserve.
And one of the strongest predictors of poor outcomes, something getting more and more emphasis, often outweighing age or even list of comorbidities, is this concept of frailty, which is more than just being old, right? It's a specific lack of physiological reserve.
Exactly. Frailty implies severely reduced resilience. A frail patient, you know, they walk slower, maybe they've lost weight without trying, they have low grip strength, they recover much slower from even minor stresses, and they deteriorate way faster if they hit a complication after surgery.
Okay.
There are formal assessments for frailty, often using simple things like gait speed or asking about exhaustion. These tools actually give us a much better way to stratify risks than just looking at the patient's birthday. Identifying frailty should force the entire team to adopt a really minimized impact approach to everything we do.
Beyond just assessing them beforehand, we also need to get better at catching injury after the fact, especially the silent kind. The source material really highlights myocardial injury after non-cardiac surgery, or MINS. This sounds alarmingly common.
It is. Up to maybe 15% of high-risk surgical patients experience it. And it's often missed because it doesn't come with the classic chest pain symptoms. The autonomic nervous system is often blunted by anesthesia and age.
So how does it show up?
Often just as subtle decompensation, maybe some fatigue, maybe a bit short of breath. Catching it really requires routine troponin checks in the first, say, 48 to 72 hours after surgery for those high-risk patients.
Why is catching it so important if it's silent?
Because even though the event itself might be silent, it carries a mortality risk similar to a spontaneous heart attack. Early detection is crucial because it signals significant cardiac stress occurred, and it helps prevent that delayed heart failure we sometimes see days or weeks later. It's an essential tool.
Okay, troponin checks. Now, We talked about how stage 3 microvascular damage leads to brain issues, so preventing postoperative neurological complications, especially delirium, that has to be a major focus of our care plan. What does a practical delirium prevention package actually look like?
Yeah, definitely. First and foremost, medication avoidance. Benzodiazepines, for example, are really strongly linked to worsening confusion and delirium, especially in older adults. They just have profound CNS depressant effects.
Avoid the benzos. Got it.
Second, selective drug use. Think about using dexmedetomidine wisely. Dexmedetomidine provides sedation, but tends to preserve respiratory drive better, and crucially, often allows for a more neurologically clear emergence.
Okay.
And third, don't underestimate simple, high-impact, low-tech strategies. Get patients moving early, get unnecessary tubes and lines out quickly, and constantly reorient the patient in the PCU and on the ward. Tell them where they are, what day it is, remind them about the surgery. Just keep them grounded.
Makes sense. And what about pain management itself? We always talk about multimodal analgesia, but are there specific hazards we need to watch out for when choosing agents for these older, complex patients?
Oh, absolutely. The complexity demands a really nuanced approach. Yes, multimodal is key, using regional blocks, acetaminophen, maybe gabapentinoids, anything, to minimize reliance on opioids, which cause respiratory depression, nausea, and definitely contribute to delirium.
Well,
but we have to be extremely cautious with NSAIDs, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. They probably need to be avoided entirely if there's any significant kidney risk, which, as we said, is common after stage 3 injury, or if the patient has stage 4 HFPEF.
Why avoid NSAIDs and HFPEF?
Because NSAIDs inhibit prostaglandin synthesis, and prostaglandins play a role in maintaining renal function and fluid balance. Blocking them can destabilize things, leading to fluid retention and acute decompensation in someone with already precarious heart function. We have to protect the kidneys, the heart, and the brain all at the same time. It's a balancing act.
It really sounds like it. And ultimately, the source material seems to reinforce this idea that none of us can really succeed alone here. The safest path forward requires, system-level cooperation.
Teamwork is absolutely non-negotiable. It's a safety tool. Establishing a really robust collaboration between anesthesia, geriatrics, maybe cardiology, a true perioperative medicine service allows for comprehensive pre-op optimization. Things like correcting anemia, stabilizing rhythm, maybe even some prehabilitation before the patient ever faces the stress of surgery. When we coordinate care across disciplines, we dramatically reduce the chance of falling into these predictable traps.
Okay, let's pivot slightly towards the future now, because the translational science seems to be rapidly giving us better ways to actually see some of these underlying conditions, especially that tricky HFPEF. We seem to be moving toward a world where we can unmask significant cardiovascular risk even before a patient shows obvious symptoms on, say, a standard EKG or a basic echo.
That's absolutely the power of modern cardiac biomarkers. We still rely on the traditional ones, of course, like BNP and NT-proBNP, which are markers for ventricular stretch. But now we have access to newer, more specific biomarkers that point more directly towards the underlying problems of fibrosis and inflammation.
But
I'm thinking specifically of things like ST2 and galectin 3. ST2 is a marker of inflammation and myocardial stress, and galectin 3 is considered a more direct marker of active fibrosis happening within the heart muscle itself.
Ah, so they tell you about the process of damage.
Exactly. Elevated levels of these newer biomarkers can give us a crucial window into that pathology, that stage 4 remodeling process that traditional tools might miss until it's much further along.
Which lets us potentially shift management much earlier. And the technology right there in the operating room is evolving too, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's not just about reacting faster anymore. It's about prediction, knowing what might be coming down the pike minutes ahead.
Yeah, AI and predictive monitoring are really starting to revolutionize acute care. They move us away from just reacting to alarms. Algorithms are now getting pretty good at analyzing lots of subtle, complex hemodynamic trends simultaneously, things like heart rate variability, subtle changes in the arterial pressure waveform shape, calculated SVR, and actually predicting a hypotensive event minutes before it dips below that critical MAP threshold.
Minutes. How many minutes?
Maybe 3 to 5 minutes, sometimes more, depending on the system and the patient. But that 3 to 5 minute head start, it gives the clinician a crucial window to maybe start a vasopressor infusion early or adjust the anesthetic depth proactively before the pressure actually drops. It helps prevent that cumulative hypotensive burden that leads to AKI and MINS.
That shift from reactive to proactive really fundamentally changes how we might approach managing these complex cases. Looking even further out, what about the really experimental stuff? Are we getting closer to actually reversing or stopping some of these age-related changes? Or are we just stuck managing the symptoms forever?
Well, the scientific community is definitely pushing hard to move beyond just managing blood pressure and towards actual disease modification. There's a lot of exploration into experimental therapies that could potentially reshape the whole trajectory of cardiovascular aging.
Like what kind of therapies?
Things like potential age rage inhibitors, trying to stop that cementation process we talked about back in stage two, preventing that profound vessel rigidity. And maybe even more exciting, for stage four HFPEF heart, people are looking seriously at targeted SERCA2A gene therapy.
Gene therapy?
Yeah. The goal would be to restore the heart muscle's ability to relax and fill properly by fixing that underlying calcium handling problem, essentially trying to undo the molecular damage that causes diastolic dysfunction. Now, these are still very much investigational early days.
Sure.
But they point towards a future where maybe we can treat the underlying disease processes of aging, not just react to the symptoms they cause.
The overall message from all this science seems pretty clear then. The future of anesthesia for our increasingly complex aging population has to be precision-guided. It has to be deeply physiology-aware, and it absolutely needs to be biomarker-driven. We just can't afford to practice one-size-fits-all care anymore.
Okay, so to bring this whole roadmap together for everyone listening, let's quickly run through those four predictable crisis points again, the ones associated with each stage of cardiovascular aging. Think of this as your mental checklist for high-stakes situations.
Right. Let's recap. 1. Stage I, loss of elasticity. The big risk is that profound, prolonged induction hypotension. Stiff pipes, sluggish baroreflex. Intervention, slow titration, have norepinephrine ready.
Okay. Stage 1, induction crash.
Stage 2, pressure dynamics. The core danger here is silent tachycardia-induced ischemia, that dangerous drop in diastolic pressure starving the heart. Intervention. Keep DBP at or above 60. Strict heart rate control, ideally 60-75.
Stage 2, diastolic lifeline and heart rate. 3. Stage 3, microvascular compromise. We have to actively prevent AKI and postoperative delirium. These come from inadequate microvascular perfusion due to failed autoregulation. Intervention. Maintain a personalized MAP, probably 70-75, and minimize any time spent below 65.
Stage 3, protect the brain and kidneys with enough pressure for long enough.
And 4, stage 4, remodeling pump HFPEF. The immediate crisis is sudden AF causing complete preload collapse in that rigid, rhythm-dependent heart. Intervention. Preserve sinus rhythm at all costs. Be super careful with PEEP and fluids.
Stage 4, rhythm is life, preload is critical.
Okay.
This whole discussion really raises an important question, I think, for everyone listening, for the practicing clinician. Given this predictable roadmap of deterioration, what is our core role, philosophically, as anesthesiologists in the modern OR?
I think our role has fundamentally evolved. It's way beyond just tweaking knobs for volume and pressure anymore. It's become a high-level diagnostic exercise, almost. It's really our responsibility now to see the specific stage of the patient's aging circulation, use the clues, biomarkers, physical signs, history to predict the likely crisis point for that patient, and then tailor the entire anesthetic and recovery plan specifically around preventing that particular failure mode.
So moving from just following protocols to deep individualized physiological understanding.
Exactly. It demands that deeper understanding.
And that really means reinforcing the importance of looking beyond just the basic vital signs. And the aging heart, things like pulse pressure, the absolute number for diastolic BP, maybe even assessing their overall frailty status. These metrics are every bit as vital as the traditional heart rate and Spiro we always watch. The stress test of surgery, the storm, it's inevitable, right? But if we understand the specific structural weaknesses in that patient's circulation, we can actually guide them safely through it, armed with precision. Thanks for joining us on today's episode of Optimal Anesthesia. For in-depth notes, visuals, and bonus content, head over to optimalanesthesia.com. Support the learning, support the craft. See you in the next one.